G'day and welcome to the Head Shepherd Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Ferguson, CEO here at NextGen Agri. I've worked in livestock farming and breeding for over 25 years, and through this journey, I've met some truly wonderful people. It's fantastic to have the opportunity to share their stories and their wisdom with you through this Head Shepherd Podcast. It's also fantastic to meet new people through the podcast, and I'm always humbled by the generosity of people that take the time to have a chat and share their stories. I also very much appreciate you, our loyal listeners, who continue to listen in and provide your feedback each week. It's very much appreciated. This podcast is supported by our good friends at Allflex and MSD Animal Health, who are guided by the one mission of the science of healthier animals. Now combined, these companies have one of the widest livestock product portfolios in Australasia with a comprehensive suite of animal health products through things like the Cooper's range and the ID and monitoring solutions that Allflex are famous for. Their products are all backed up by their exceptional service, and we are really proud to continue to have their support in bringing this podcast to you each week. Okay, let's get this show on the road. Welcome back to Head Shepherd. Thanks all out there for listening. Great to have you listening along through season six. Getting along through season six now, and got some great guests coming along, and a great one today, Renee Hogg. Welcome to Head Shepherd.
Thank you, Mark.
Renee, for those who don't know you that well, it'd be good if you could just run us through your background, sort of where your interest in ag began, and what you do now.
Yeah, and I think I've always been interested in ag, Mark, for as long as I can remember, and just always really wanted to go farming, I think. And I always had a vision or my work, I guess, on the fact that I wanted to create an industry. I wanted to go farming in and then go farming in it. So that sort of directed me, I guess, as I've kind of moved into roles and transitioned around the industry. So I currently run my own business, which is a sort of a consulting business, and it's 5 or 6 years old now, which is great, and it allows me to do a lot of what I want to do. It's mostly around problem solving with farmers and industry, and just working on some of the challenges we're facing and how we get there. And a lot from me is driven from, I guess, my early working days in the industry. I was heavily involved in the apple industry to start out with, funnily enough, not sheep and beef. And worked for the apple and pear marketing board before that deregulated. So had an interesting period as a young person in the industry, I guess, going through that change and really understanding why farmers and growers wanted to move away from the single desk and some of the constraints around them working in that structure. And then I went out on my own, actually had my own business just around quality and management, and again helping exporters export apples in a deregulated environment. Went from one exporter to, I think, 99 overnight. Global Gap came in as well from Europe. That was around Greenpeace had tested some apples in Germany, I think it was, or a European country anyway, and found high residues. And I think might have been the winter, actually. I was starting my own business, and Global Gap had to be on orchards in New Zealand before the start of the season, so before February the next year. So it was a major change for them. But, yeah, apple is very, very, you know, I think apples are growing for the market. They're very aware of the markets and products are growing for. There's a lot of protocols behind the spray. For example, colour, size of fruit that you've got to work with really early on to get those products to that market. And just the way the companies and the exporters work with the apple growers, you know, exactly that, understand the colour size and the trade-off for what that does to your trees. So that was really influential for me and my thinking. I was working for Bostock, for John Bostock, for a part of that, and, you know, really interesting person to work for and really sort of set me up, I guess, as a young person, and gave me a lot of confidence too, Mark, as John does to all, you know, he's very good with young people like that. So that sort of set me on the path, and I went back into red meat after that and to Brisington Breedline. And so, Risington Breedline approached me. They've been approached by Marks and Spencer, a big UK retailer and a very high-quality retailer. And they were obviously red meat genetics company, so they were in sheep and beef genetics. And, this was, 2006, I think, so we're going back a long time ago now. And trying to get their product value. So their product was genetics, but their genetics probably worth what the industry was prepared to pay for it. And they had a really, really interesting approach to that, which was to get more product, more value for the product of their products, if you like, in the market. So that's your carcass, that's your meat. And that was their way of, I'll say, justifying, but I think there were, you know, there were a lot of attributes and genetics outside of this, but the leveler was, didn't matter what genetics you used, you still got schedule for your beef and lamb. So they were really around breaking that model, and really it just fascinated me what they were trying to do, and I was fully behind it and really thankful for that opportunity to go and work for them. And just help them set their supply up with Marks & Spencer. That was pretty unique at its time, because not only were they working sort of outside the normal industry ways of working, if you want, here in New Zealand, but they were also exporting genetics to the UK and working with UK farmers and retailers over there. So we had a 12-month supply of product. We had an in-season New Zealand, so October, November through to May supply in New Zealand, and then the retailers could flick over. So that was really important, because those customers don't just want us there for 6 months of the year, they want us there for 12 months of the year. And trying to get a, you know, there's a lot of attributes around age of livestock for one, but just that in-season product was really key value for Marks & Spencer. So yeah, I think they were working really ahead of their time in all the right things, Mark. If I can say the right things, you know, they were really developing our supply and value chain and doing the right things to make sure that could function, which I don't think has been done since in red meat. We sort of hear Bonterra with milk, milk products, and how they extract different products out of milk. Be that milk powder and what they do with it. Zespri have got a great model, the licensing and getting product all around the world, so they've got that scalability and that 12-month supply again. And Apple, so I think Rocket's the new Apple variety, that sort of similar model with the licensing and the global growers. So it was great to see that in red meat at that time.
That would have been well before its time, like, yeah, and yeah. Anyway, 15 years.
And I think there was 120 farms involved in that in New Zealand, that from not quite Northland, but sort of King Country to Southland.
What was the key point of difference that sort of in a consumer's, or what was the marketable difference that you were trying to work on?
I think it was the consistency of product and the consistency of the way that product was grown. The farmers were all what they were doing on farms. So then, you know, we had land and environment plans on farm back then. So that was, and they all had them. So that was the beef and lamb and land and environment plan, sort of level 2 and 3. And, you know, cracking up, we're talking a long time ago now.
Yeah.
But they were all the farms. We were working on animal welfare. We were working on carbon and trees, you know, right back then. So just a very progressive group of farmers, I think, that retail, and the UK retailers are ahead of everybody else anyway. And we were very much working towards the values of that supermarket, that retail chain.
You know where that ended up? Did it ultimately fold into something else or disappear or still going? I haven't.
Yes, that was sort of the concept was brought by a meat company, and I see two of us from Britain for Breedline transitioned into that business when that came about, and it got, I'll just say, diluted.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, it's quite intense trying to manage the farmers, the supply chain and the customer. And I think the key part there was managing the UK farmers and their work around this as well. They were a key part of that, because that was a real point of differentiation as well, is that it was 12 months of the same genetics. So, yeah, so that it just got lost in a bit bigger scale. That company was trying to scale it up, but you sort of get all the usual problems with trying to do a value chain within a New Zealand meat company. Again, back at the time, so it was probably 2010 when that happened, 2009. So, you know, 12 years ago now, and the meat industry's changed a lot since then. But at the time, it certainly wasn't ready for the concept.
Yeah, and I reckon we'll come back to value chains because that's an interest area of mine. I have very little knowledge of it, but I have a lot of interest in it. I guess just if we focus a little bit on inside New Zealand at the moment, what's your typical client these days and what sort of work are you doing?
Hey everyone, my name is Catalina. I'm a two-time cancer survivor and a babe with a mobility aid.
My name is Haley. I'm a PA with POTS and a water allergy. We are the hosts of the Doing It Disabled podcast.
Haley and I are on a mission to create an honest dialogue about living with disability and chronic illness. We would like to open up our corner of the internet to both learn and teach about the lived experiences of the disabled community.
Join us as we navigate this world that was not created with us in mind and watch how we do it disabled. Head on over to Spotify and check us out.
Yeah, so it's, and I've sort of tried to manage a little bit of risk and a little bit of where do I want to take the business going forward. So it's broken into three parts, and one part governance, one part doing sort of, I'll say part-time, but it's a few hours a week on a longer-term scale. So that for me was PAMU. I did some work for PAMU, and currently I'm with AgriHQ, one of the analysts in the Insight team, which is just, you know, it's fabulous. That is, I learn a lot. Stay completely on the market, both in New Zealand and international, and just really keep your finger on the pulse markers to what's happening in those export markets, where our products are going, and you see the changes. So why are we changing from the States to China? Which back to that real interest in value change, you know, that's really key for me. So really lucky to have that role and really enjoy it. And then the third part is projects and consulting to the industry. And, you know, I think I said at the start, I'm a problem solver, really like working with businesses on strategy. So where are they now? Where do they want to be? And what's standing in the way of them getting there? And starting to look at where the income is going to come from. So if we look 10 years out, how is that farm going to be structured? What percentage sheep, what percentage beef, and others, I think, that they're trying to diversify these businesses, because that's something I think that we're going to need to do with sheep and beef farms. And the other question is, who will be farming it? So when you look out long-term and take a long-term approach, is that children at succession? Is it other family members? Is it potentially going to go up for sale? And how do we do something today with that in mind?
That sounds like pretty fascinating. Fascinating combination of roles.
Yeah, well, keeps it interesting, and it keeps you across everything. And, yeah, I feel really lucky to be able to do it all, really. So key for me now is how do I grow the business? So that's just bubbling away in the back of my thinking now, and just taking that, scaling it up, really. How do I add some more horsepower to it and give it a bigger reach?
Yeah, excellent. And we'll definitely put your contact details in the show notes so that anyone wants to reach out.
Thank you.
So we'll make sure people can find you. There was, at the start, you mentioned you were going to set up the industry and then go farming in it. Is that still the plan, or are you like me, you've sort of given up on the fact that you'll farm one day? Or?
I'm still saving that. But then thinking maybe I'll be farming something other than what I thought I'd be farming. But, it's still the dream. So that's the, you know, that's definitely the goal, I guess. More than a dream now, a goal. And, yeah, I guess I've done a lot of travel, the last kind of 15 years for me has been all over the world, really, in lots of different roles and lots of different countries, even if it's just visiting. It's all been about egg. And it's actually nice to be closer to home and not been on sort of planes, trains and automobiles all the time. So for me, that's, you know, it's the time to do that. It's just to sort of settle down and not do so much travel, really. And really start to enjoy the work you're doing for yourself, you know.
And it's, I mean, having been in business roughly the same amount of time, a little bit shorter, but yeah, it's certainly a different when you actually stand and try and build your own thing. And it's got its own set of challenges, but also a lot of rewards. COVID's been good at keeping us grounded and making us focus on what we can do closer to home, which has had some negatives, but some plenty of positives as well. I just want to quickly work out, or just ask you about how you came up with the name Inside New Zealand and what the sort of meaning there is, and then we'll get on to that, some other questions.
Well, that is a funny story. So when I came home from the UK, I came home with the intention of importing these things called roundhouse buildings, which was a UK style of housing, and just the rounds. Yeah, they're round and they've got a fabric roof and in yards in the middle. And I did quite a bit of work with the owner of that business in the UK, and also saw them in my travels out on farms in the UK, and they really sort of stood out to me as one, an innovative way of housing livestock, but they weren't just a square building that had one purpose, which was housing livestock. They were yards as well. You'll have to look them up, Mark. So that was the intention, was to come home and bring those with me and add another string to the bow with that. You know, a very good friend of mine, who's much cleverer with words than me, turned that to the inside, came from the concept of housing animals in New Zealand through that design.
Yeah, righto. Well, yeah, that wasn't the answer I was expecting, so that's cool.
a bit long-winded.
No, it just kind of works. It's a cool business name, so I was just keen to understand where it came from, but that's,
a lot of people try and say inside New Zealand, but no, it's inside. So that business got sold to the Dutch, an existing Dutch building. So it moved on. It just got too hard. The business model completely changed and the ownership of the actual people who owned the buildings changed. And it made it just impossible, but it's something I've still just kept my eye on with a view to maybe setting one up at least here in New Zealand somewhere.
Yeah, cool. I will look it up and see what they look like, and look forward to seeing one here one day. Mm-hmm. You've got a strong history and interest in value chains, and you've already talked about a number of value chains you've had a key part in. What does the future hold for New Zealand-based value chains? We've heard, lots of things over the last few years, but what's your view?
I think they're going to change a lot, Mark. I think we use the term value chain loosely, particularly red meat. I think, as mentioned before, dairy industry and a lot of the core products are much more, correct in their terminology of value chain. So how do we get the red meat? And I guess my passion is red meat, so vegan lamb. How do we bring that concept into vegan lamb production under the current structures in the businesses? And it's hard because we've got the carcass balance is hard, all the products that come from an animal, whether that's the pelt or the hides, the co-products, and co-products are doing really well. I think the value of those is increasing hugely. So we've sort of got to factor them into our thinking as well, as is hides and skins at the minute. So I think the first thing is just to define the products, and is there any other products we can come up with? And we sort of, when we talk about the carcass, we talk about a whole carcass or quarters or muscle cuts or however we said that. So I think it's keeping the innovations, we're keeping ourselves open to innovation on the carcass, as well as the value add on all the rest of the animal. New markets, I think we've done a lot to trade. There's been a lot done to increase access to countries, and that's been significant in sort of the last number of years, really. And I think it's getting easier. So the ability for us to trade with existing countries and new countries is going to make that easier. But I think the downside of that is one of the challenges we have is that we are so far from market. So what can we look at domestically? And close at home, that we're doing, China, Asia, and Australia also. And I'd really like to see us doing something in our own market, in the domestic market as well. which would be, yeah, it'll be great to see something there. So how do we distribute value? So how do we get value from the market back to the farmer, and how's that, say, evenly split? But for the value chain to work, every part of that value chain needs to be rewarded for the part it does, and it needs some trust and transparency in there somewhere. So just a bit more transparent, and, you know, potentially moving away from the schedule base. Why we're on schedule and everybody sort of paid the same thing, it's really hard to properly create a value chain as well. So I think the way we price livestock, the way we work with farmers around that, you know, what could change there to help us? If you look at the Fonterra model or the dairy model, apples is very different. So we've got pool payments and you know, it, the sort of the extreme in the apple industry, if we bring that back as an example, is growers aren't paid until the exporter is paid. So you've grown the fruit, you've harvested the fruit, you've packed the fruit, which is all your expense. It's then shipped to market, sold in market, and that money, you know, takes a wee while to get back home again. So you're carrying the cost of your production for a long time, but you get a more real value of what that product is, and that's not always a good value mark. So there's lots of, I think, lots of challenges in and around that. I did a bit of time actually working in Egypt with some cucumber farmers, and their NGOs were funding these Egyptian farmers to put up pet houses, and it was really interesting. So we went in to work with the farmers who were all growers, so they all grew cucumbers and okra, and they had all this funding and money to set up a pet house. And I remember working with the guys we were working with, and it was all done through interpreters, and you know, really it was interesting because there's two of us, both women, trying to work with men, and you know, there was a lot of challenges really getting the relationship built for a start and getting the communication going. Like, we couldn't sit down and have lunch with them as an example. So, and just, you know, I think for us ladies that aren't used to that, it was a bit of a challenging environment. But we got there, and we actually talked our guys into putting up shade houses because, you know, as we sort of said to them, everyone's going to have pet houses, and where's all the product going to come from pet? Do something different, and let's try and, you know, just the supply curve and tried to work in the fringes. So we were producing cucumbers outside of the main season and getting those guys to think a little bit differently outside. We've got this money to build a pet house, let's build a pet house. So we actually got them to put up shade houses or greenhouses so they could grow earlier and later. But sorry, back to New Zealand, I think that there's a lot of challenges coming. I'll say challenges, but animal welfare is going to be huge. So I think how we address that as an industry will be really key. And I think that we've just been through a very big shake-up on environment. And, you know, how farmers see how they manage the environment and how consumers see how they manage the environment are two different viewpoints. So I guess what lessons can we learn from that as we move into the animal welfare debate, because I think it's going to be very similar. And I think more than anything structural or definite, we're working with social views, not science, and we're working with market constructs. So things like regen ag, things like animal welfare, they're all attributes, I guess, to be built into the product and the story behind them, and how do we prove that? So I think, and there's been a bit of work done through Trust Alliance, just the data and blockchain and back to farm, I think that's going to be really key. Mark, and again, you know, potentially tagging these animals, but not from a, you know, we're tagging beef and deer currently for traceability and disease outbreaks like bovis. But how do we use that data that we can get from those tags to tell our story and to prove the care of the animal or other attributes? You know, there's lots you can do around management and production with them. But how, from a consumer perspective, how do we package that up and package up groups of farmers so we get a critical mass around a particular thing that our customers are really interested in and follow that through plants. So I think, as I say, data, definitely blockchain, and I'd be really keen to see more done in the sector on that and help build a value chain, if you like, a way forward with it, with that data behind it. So at farm level, trucking, just 8-hour trucking, there's a lot of trucking that's really critical to the perception of how we farm and what we do in the plants. And I think, just the whole slaughter thing is not, consumers don't have a good appetite for that discussion. So, vet the animal welfare structures, if you like, are talking about a good life and a good death. So as an industry, often don't talk about that either. So how do we assure our consumers that animals have a good death and what actually is a good death? And are we ensuring that that's happening in our industry? So, and back to diversification on farm, I think farms are going to be significantly different with what they're farming and how they're farming them. And just we still need the critical mass. So the industry needs to be of a size so that we are recognised in the market. And what's that going to look like, in 10 years and then 20 years? We've had a significant decline in livestock in the last 20 years. So is that a watch out for us? And do we need to start looking at how we can build those numbers back up? We've got challenges with greenhouse gases and the perception of that, but with the new, data research, just integrating trees into our farming systems, is there a way we can rebuild those numbers? It's been a really good discussion with the deer industry and some of the companies involved in that just before Christmas, and they are really interesting in their approach to how they've sort of rebuilt venison, which is a really good new story, I guess, at the minute. One around the collaboration with the companies into market and the work they're doing with the customers, but also they're working with their farmers to give them confidence to rebuild their capital stock, which is really, it's fascinated me because it's the first time I've heard of the marketing efforts going back behind the farm gate and ensuring they've got supply building to support what they're doing in the market. So that, is an interesting concept, and I'd love to see that happen with sheep and beef as well.
Yeah, cool. Some really interesting concepts there. And I think what you started off with, which is true, that we've sort of got commodity supply chains that we're calling value chains, but they haven't really changed too much.
Yeah, and it's operational. It is a commodity value chain. They're reliant on efficiency and scale. And I think, I think we just need to have a good look at the mark, because our scale, we're losing scale. Which is going to feed efficiency. So in the big beast, those companies, a lot of infrastructure there. So what happens there, and how's that going to impact the value chain?
Yeah, cool. And I was going to ask you about what 20 years out looks like, but I think we've sort of covered that pretty well. Certainly some change coming, and the importance of welfare and that data piece. Very much share that view, and I think there's a lot of transparency to come.
I think connect to market, less of a commodity, building the opportunity for these value chains. It will change a lot of dynamics from farm to market, and I think the leadership in the sector too, Mark, it's going to take, it's a bit fragmented at the moment. So how do we get some really good, strong leadership that's got a good direction that everybody's behind as well?
Yeah, definitely.
R&D, all the usual things. So research and development, innovation, and how do we get more people involved in those decisions?
Yeah, 100% sure.
We're always going to be dislocated from the market. It's always going to be a long way away from it. So how do we turn some of our weaknesses into strengths, I guess?
Yeah, I think history will tell us that it's done by individuals doing great things rather than waiting for someone else to do it. So.
That's the fact, yeah. And I think the challenge we've got is that the capital required, there's a really good new model with a mobile beef packer at the minute. It's small scale, but the capital required to get some of these small ideas that are great to scale is hard, and I don't, you know, don't necessarily have that capital key to do that either.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. And I guess with ag and ag tech being a lot sexier than it was at least a decade ago, there is, I guess, different capital streams than you might not have had 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, and we've still got labour constraints, haven't we? Like, it's hard to get, and it's compounded with COVID. But so we're bringing in labour, but it's still a largely manual, you know, whether that's horticulture or agriculture. Arable, not so much, but we're still reliant on that manual labour for a lot of it.
Yeah, and I guess that's the other thing will change. I mean, something's always going to be manual, but with we're seeing automation happen across all aspects of ag, and I think it's crazy not to predict that's going to increase. But I guess I want to just cover off in your governance roles before we close out. You've had a number and a number, and I guess one that I don't know what the New Zealand Meat Board do, so I was interested to hear what the role of that group is and the strategies that you're working on there as an example, and any other governance things that you're working on.
Yeah, so the New Zealand Meat Board is really interesting. It's a statutory board, so it's regulated by the Meat Board Act of 2004, and it's got two jobs. So its first job is to manage the quota. So our exporters access to quota markets, and that's worth $2.3 billion this year has been. And the other role it manages livestock farmer reserves. So they're sitting at just over 80 million, and the board looks after those and distributes them out, looks after them, but they provide grant funding as industry good funding as well. So those, it's quite a, that's the role of the New Zealand Meat Board, Mark.
So that funding typically goes to, or as an example, beef and lamb, or to ag research, or to what sort of?
The New Zealand Meat Board AGM is next month, and every year that funding is put to farmers to say, this is what we're going to do with the funding. It's a proposal by beef and lamb, and the farmers, New Zealand farmers, get to have a say on whether that's what they want their reserves to be doing.
All right, cool. Last question, I'll let you go and do some work at some point for the day, and this we just added to the podcast recently. Either your favourite day on the job or the favourite part of your job?
my favourite part's working with farmers and either solving a problem or putting together a project and some funding for them when you it's sort of more than a one-on-one kind of problem solve. And just seeing the successes there, Mark. So seeing them get from A to B, whether that's, you know, one farm on something small or a group of farms, you know, on a challenge. It might be parasite resistance, it might be something, but just, I think, you know, I really enjoy that work.
Yeah, fantastic. And, yeah, definitely the best part of my job as well, and probably anyone that works with farmers.
Really rewarding, and you can see the results.
Yeah, 100%. Thanks, Renee. Awesome chat. You mentioned at the start that you weren't sure what the hell we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Proving that wrong. So,
I think, what value change. Hamish Gow's doing a lot. You know, there's a lot of, so Hamish Gow's at Lincoln. I think Nick Lee's at Lincoln as well. There's a lot of the me people, Mark, out there doing it.
That's for others to decide, not you. So, We'll leave it there. But, yeah, thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate you coming on, Head Shepherd, and look forward to catching up soon.
You're welcome. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for listening to the Head Shepherd podcast. If you enjoy listening in each week, please take a moment to subscribe or even give us a review. That'd be fantastic. And if you do get a moment to share it with your networks, we'd also love that so that we can share these great stories with more people. Thanks again to our friends at Allflex for sponsoring this episode. Allflex are wonderful supporters of the Australian and New Zealand livestock industries. Combined now with MSD Animal Health, they offer one of New Zealand and Australia's largest livestock product portfolios focused on animal health and management, all backed up by that exceptional service. We really do enjoy our long-term association with Allflex and thank them very much for again supporting us with bringing this podcast to you.